Would you please state your name, the date, the time, and your location?
My name is Tammy Wilkerson Hill Fisher. The date is August 6th, Saturday, 2022. And yes, oh, my location. My location is Albuquerque, New Mexico, United States.
And what time is it where you are?
It is 2:17 p.m.
And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under a Creative Commons license attribution non-commercial share alike?
Yes.
Thank you so much for being here. Would you please start by introducing yourself to anyone who might find themselves listening? What would you want them to know about you and the place you're speaking from?
Ooh. So, brief history from me is things that I think are significant, you know, as they play out, and especially with the pandemic, is I am an African-American female, and I will tell you why that's important later on. I am a mother. I am self-employed, but most of my work is around my family, and so I work, I'll say I'm self-employed and I work part-time. That's a better way of describing it. I'm also an artist. During the pandemic, I became a podcaster, and I am also a doll expert. And my primary focus is in how minorities, you know, in the DEI space, and having more representation with dolls. So that's how all of that's going to play in later with what happened for me during the pandemic.
Tell me a story about your life during the pandemic.
So I think that when the pandemic first started, it almost felt like a joke. And, you know, here we are years into it. And it's like that would be some really bad joke. Not funny at all. But what started happening is, so we saw people, we saw that there was something going on in China. And then it looked like it was starting to spread. And then they started shutting down countries, saying, you know, we are not going to have any people like America. No people from China can come here. And then that the countries that were not allowed to come into the United States, the people from those countries became more and more, became numerous as what was happening was the virus was spreading. So we saw that happening. But in America, we weren't really seeing it yet. And we saw people buying toilet paper. And so it was like this joke. It's like, they're saying this is some type of a respiratory illness. Are they going to be blowing their noses? What's that about? So we saw people buying toilet paper and water. And it was just, it was like, what is this? This is just kind of crazy. And so it had this kind of humorous tone initially, because it didn't make any sense the way people were behaving. And then we started hearing more about it. Then, you know, that was in, I think it probably started, because they're talking about New Year. So it probably started the top of 2019. And so for me, when it started to feel real was when they shut things down. And that was like April. I think it was like the top of April, end of March, early April, somewhere around. They started shutting things down. And here in New Mexico, our governor, Michelle Lujan Grisham, came out with these really strict guidelines. And they were, you could not have more than five people anywhere. The significance of that is I live in a state where there are lots of Catholics and there are lots of Mormons. And traditionally, people who practice those religions have many children. So when they came out with this rule that you cannot be out in more than five, there was this confusion. And I remember listening to there was a interview with, I can't remember what you call it, but it was, just a public interview where she was addressing the public. And one of the reporters said, "Oh, but you don't mean like, you don't like literally mean five. You mean like if you have like five kids, you and your partner and your five kids can go grocery shopping." She said, "No, I mean five. You should not be in groups of more than five. So if you have five kids, then you got to figure out who's at home because all of you cannot come out. Now, you can be cited by the police. I don't know that the police would literally cite you, but you are like technically like breaking the law. And I can't remember exactly how she stated that, but you are, I mean, you could be cited, so you are breaking the law. So people were talking about, well, what if we went to the park? It doesn't matter. If you're at the park, you're at the grocery store, you should not, wherever you are, you should not be in groups of more than five. So that was really interesting. And then she says, you should choose one person from your family to be your designated person so that you have fewer people out and about. Now, one of the other things at this point that had happened with the shutdowns was your children were not in school. Okay, so everybody's at home. So my husband, at this time, my husband is working from home. He works for the National Laboratories. He's at home. And my children are adults. And so one of them was in university and she was at home. And then my other child started university actually during the pandemic. And that's another story. So how all this stuff wraps back around on itself. So we were all at home. So my husband was our designated person. So he was the one who went shopping and those kinds of things. Now, New Mexico is one of the states where the Navajo Nation runs through. So you have the United States, and then you have like this, it's another government that it's a Native American government. First Nations. And so it runs through New Mexico. And I can't remember all of the states. I think Arizona, there's some other states that it runs through. So our mayor contacted the president of the Navajo Nation and said, look, this looks like this is going to be big. And so they started working together. One of the things you need to know is that there are some of the pueblos do not have running water. So, one of the first things they told us to do was that we needed to keep our hands washed. They did not know how things were spreading. So, they said, keep your hands washed, cover up your face, don't be around a lot of people, just basically isolate as much as you can. So, imagine how big of a burden it would have been upon you if you did not have running water. And you had to go out and get water because you can't just, go into the bathroom, turn the water on, and wash your hands. You have to go out and source water. I mean, they go out, they get water, and they bring it back to to their homes. So that becomes a big issue. Then another thing that happens within the Navajo Nation and some of the other pueblos, there are many pueblos here in New Mexico. But another thing that happens is there aren't many jobs in the pueblos. There are some touristy kind of jobs where people come in, but for the most part, people who live in the pueblos, they are working in the cities. That's where most of the jobs are. So they're going out doing their jobs and coming back home. So if you are anybody, whether you're native or not native, and you have a job that's like a public service job where you need to be out. You are out and you are amongst people. So if you're like a health provider, let's say you work in a hotel, or well, they shut down restaurants, but just that kind of, maybe you do janitorial work someplace, just bus driver, those kinds of jobs where people had to go to work. Those people then were having contact with other people. So what ended up happening was you had people going from the Navajo Nation and coming back home, and they also tend to live in multi-generational houses. So you might be in the house with great grandma and grandma, and just many generations of people are all in the house together. So you come home with COVID and your family catches it. So people who are less healthy, who are elderly, there are certain populations of people who are more likely to get it. And so you'd go, someone come home and just devastate a household because you've got so many people in there. And so it was really wild. In America, excuse me, it's expensive to bury people. And apparently there's something that is supposed to happen with Native people where they're supposed to get monies from the government to bury people. Now, I don't know if that happens all the time or if that's what happened with COVID. Anyway, the people did not get this money. So we were seeing all these GoFundMes. And it was so sad because you'd see someone would say, "Oh, my uncle died, and we need to bury my uncle." So, people are donating money to help bury their uncle. "Oh, my sister died." Same person. "My sister died. My brother died." And it was really heavy to see so many deaths in such a small population. So that was, part of what happened. Then, as an African American, I said I would tell you why that was important. We too tend to be people who are working in the help type positions. So we saw this huge death. We were just dying. And again, a lot of us are in multi-generational households. It's not uncommon, but maybe in America it's not uncommon. But for grandma to be there. So you've got a grandmother and she's out working, and you got the mom may not be in the house, and kids. And but again, you're seeing these households of people who tend to be, and I'm speaking as an African American, but for those of us who are of color, those of us who are lesser educated, those of us who are more financially fragile, these were the populations who were being hit really, really hard. And it was devastating. So, again, we had that happen. In my personal life, what happened was I had a friend who was like a sister to me. She worked for the public transportation system in Denver for RTD, the regional, I think it's Regional Transportation District or something like that. RTD is the bus system. And she did not have the monies to be able to work from home. She was actually a call center worker. And so she, Frances, was really beautiful. She loved to sew and she loved to give gifts. So Frances was making these cloth masks. That's what happened initially. It was cloth masks that they were asking us to make and use. And so it became a way for us to, we were keeping ourselves safe from COVID and we were supporting each other. So there were people who lost jobs, could not work, just that kind of, you know, people were just being impacted financially. So by purchasing masks from these people, we were able to help to support them. So Frances was one of these people who, she still had her job, but she liked to sew and she was single. And so Frances was making masks and Frances was sending masks all over the country to her friends and family and people she loved. And Frances passed and it was really strange. Frances was a vegan and she was really into her health. And she went every year. They have this Nine News Health Fair in Denver. She'd go and she'd get her blood work done and all that. She did the right stuff. She took care of herself. Well, Frances died from diabetes. And it's like, how would Frances die from diabetes? It made absolutely no sense to any of us that Frances would have passed from diabetes. So we couldn't put it together. And then, you know, the story that we were told was, you know, she was, a friend had called her, and thank God that they had that brief conversation. But Frances told her, you know, I'm not feeling well. I'm going to, you know, I need to call you back later. And Frances didn't hang up the phone. She just laid the phone down. Well, this friend tried to reach her for like 3 days and she couldn't reach her. And this friend also had worked with Frances. So she called Frances at work and couldn't reach her. And she called, so she called the manager and said, hey, where's Frances? I'm trying to reach her. I've been trying to reach her for 3 days. Manager's like, I don't know. Frances hasn't come into work. She hasn't called in and, you know, she's really responsible. So this is unusual. So the friend then calls the police. They go to her house. They find Frances's body. So that was just really crazy. And we, through looking, you know, doing some research, one of the friends, her husband is he's doing some graduate level work, and he was doing some work. And one of the things that they found, they had not released out yet, I think it was early, was that COVID could impact your body and cause it to go into like a diabetic shock and the whole diabetes and kill you. So that's the only thing that made any sense to us with Frances. Her death certificate says she died from diabetes, but I think Frances died from COVID. And so then there became this whole long, I'll just tell you a little bit about it, but this whole long drawn out thing. When Frances passed, she left everything to me and to Grace, to two of her friends. And so then, you know, the family was not happy that Frances did not leave them things. And so then I'm still dealing, and this is 2022, still dealing with Frances's estate, but that was my first real COVID experience, was Frances's death. So a friend of mine and I had been talking about doing a podcast. We are both doll lovers. She is a history-making doll maker, Georgette Taylor, and she did the Big Beautiful Dolls, she and her friend Audrey. And Georgette came to me and she says, you know, we should do this podcast. First, she came to me years ago, we should do this doll show. And at that point, I didn't know anything about dolls. She came to me, you know, again a few years later and said, let's do this podcast. And I was like, yeah, I don't know anybody. So then she came to me like maybe a year later and said, you know, we should really do a podcast. I was like, okay, now I know a few people. Let's do this. So Georgette had an idea and I had a network. And so together we created In the Doll World. So In the Doll World is a podcast YouTube channel that introduces doll lovers and doll creators. And it is it's revolutionary in that you have these people who are like celebrities, and they're celebrity doll makers. And for people who are not part of the doll world, it's like, what is that? How does that work? And so for people who are in the doll world, it's like, oh, it's like you meet the Steve Jobs of the doll world, or these people who are doing these great things, and they're history-making doll makers. This one articulated the modern fashion doll. This one created the first art, 3D printed art doll. And this one created, I mean, it's just all these different people. So we ended up, I knew some of them already, and from that, and then from them introducing me to other people, we go on, and so in the doll world begins. And my background is in journalism. So I saw, when I saw what was happening, I realized what we were witnessing was going to be historically significant. So we started asking people about what was happening in their part of the world with COVID. And so we quickly became international. So we had people telling us about, oh, I was in China, I was in Ukraine, I was in, Poland, I was, and this is what's happening over here. So that became part of what we did. One of the people that we ran into was Joseph Zekeris. He is the creator of the Glamoraz doll line. Joseph is significant historically. He will, if you were writing the history on dolls, Joseph will be significant in that he created the first line of fashion dolls from Australia. He also has a position that is kind of controversial in that he created the first black doll from that was, produced, not like a single doll, but like from Australia. So there were some issues with people saying, he should be giving money to the indigenous peoples because he made a black doll. And so that there's all that going on, and I understand we're indigenous. I understand that we need to support indigenous people, but it's not like he's like this huge person who's making a ton of money. He's a doll artist. Joseph happened to be in China when COVID kicked off. So Joseph's story is significant in that, what happened was countries started calling their people back home from China. If you're an American, you're in China, you need to, come up out of there because it's not safe for you there. Do it Australia, you need to come up out of there. And he's like, no, I'm gonna stay here and do my dolls, because he had been having such a hard time getting his dolls made that he decided to move to China. He says, I want my dolls to be a certain quality. And to make sure that my dolls are that quality, I'm gonna be here at the factory. So he literally lived in an apartment across the street from the factory where his dolls were being made. So when Australia called their people home, he didn't go. And so Joseph has this amazing story of being there. And then it's like he gets to the point where it doesn't matter whether he wants to stay or not, he cannot leave. So he tells you, about, he says, I was walking down the street and they had these stations set up where they would check your temperature. And he said, so like there were only, I think, two like restaurant fast food kind of places open. And so he went to Kentucky, was it Kentucky Fried? Anyway, it was two American places that were open there. And he said he got his temperature tested, I think it was like three times on the way there and three times on the way back. And In China, if your temperature was elevated, they took you somewhere. So it was, very concerning to be there. And Joseph said, I could look out the window and I would see the police would stop cars and they would scan every person in the car to see if somebody's temperature was elevated. So they were really, it was scary, to be in a situation where that's going on. And he said, the only thing I had, as far as feeding myself in my room, I had a, it was like a an electric tea kettle. So he didn't have like a microwave or whatever. So he could go to, I can't remember if the shop was in the building, like in the hotel that he was in or near. But he was saying, so I ate a whole bunch of noodles because that's what I could cook. So we had that happen. And it was just, there were some really beautiful things that happened within the doll world and talking to these people about their experiences and being able to, it's like being able to give voice to what they were experiencing and to say, yeah, it really is true. Because I think for a lot of us, COVID, and it's still, I'm going to say for me, I still feel this way. COVID doesn't really feel real. Time feels different. The world feels different. And so we were seeing like these amazing things happening, like in Venice. The water was really clear. Water hadn't been clear, maybe, I don't know, maybe since man had been there, but the water was really clear in the, I'm sorry, let my dog in. Come on, Bo. Hello, boo boo. Hello, boo. Good boy. So the water was really clear in Venice, and there were swans in the water and fish. And it's like, oh, wow, look at what's happening in Venice. And then we started seeing dolphins, in places like along the shore in Florida and along the shore near, not in the Venice Canal itself, but in, that area. Then we talked to people in some of the South American countries. There were like cats, big cats, like pumas were out. And I think that I saw something where like there were more javelina out in Arizona. I mean, just we saw nature without us in her beauty. In India, there were, I think it was flamingos. There were all these birds. But it was like nature got a chance to celebrate and to be free in a way that she hadn't been in so long, and so many species were just like dancing and celebrating. And we were blessed to be here, be alive, to be able to see them doing these incredible things. So I thought that that was really cool. And that was, part of that whole In the Doll World story. I left In the Doll World December of last year because I realized I was doing a lot of work for In the Doll World. I was meeting some wonderful people. I mean, it was a lot of fun. It was a blessing. But I wasn't able to spend as much time with my family as I wanted to. And my children are adults. And so, like I said, one of them, when COVID started, was in university. Now, both of them are in university. So they were both attending university from home. And I realized that there was this blessing that came with COVID. And the blessing was my family had this extended time to live together. And so I would hear my husband and my children laughing and playing games and whatever, and I was in here working. And I said, no, that's not really what I want to do. Because for me, in the doll world was a project of love. I enjoyed it. It was interesting. It was fun. I learned a whole bunch. I didn't make any money. It wasn't about the money for me. And I think maybe if it was a money making thing, maybe I would have stayed there because I needed the money. I don't know. But anyway, it wasn't. And I'm blessed to have enough to be able to be home. I jokingly say I've been on maternity leave for 23 years. So I don't have to work. I can be on maternity leave. Yeah, that's. You asked, I can't remember what the question was, but it was like I think about what happened. Tell me a story. Okay, I gave you a whole book.
I'm so grateful. To the extent that you're comfortable sharing, would you say something about your experiences with health and healthcare structure pre-pandemic?
Health and healthcare structure pre-pandemic. So I am an American who was educated both in America and Britain. So I have a different take on, I think, on the health system because of that. So I'm going to say that as an American who has lived outside of this country in another country where they have free healthcare in place, I don't find the American healthcare system to be very friendly, and especially not to people who are impoverished. So, and I think that the healthcare system actually impedes our people in that it hampers creativity and innovation because you can't just go out there and just do research or whatever. Most people can't because they need to eat. So we don't have some of the innovation that we have that we would have if we had free education. And one of the things that is said about the American educational system and the way we raise our children is that our children play more than children in some other countries, and that then sparks this innovation. And so it's kind of crazy. So you live in this country that sparks this innovation, but you don't have the support there to really nourish it and benefit as a people from that innovation. So that's my general take on that. Specifically, we have decent health care, we have decent insurance. Even so, one of my children was diagnosed with a chronic pain condition, and that was about started maybe in 2006. And so we took the kid in, had all these tests done, I couldn't find anything. And that's when my kid was six. At 10, my child was hospitalized for chronic pain. They couldn't figure out what was going on. Again, we have decent health care. That year, my family spent approximately $20,000 on uncovered things. So, co-pays, medicine, Eastern doctors, just we spent $20,000. And I don't know when people are going to be looking at this, but I think that if you are a family, I can't remember what is I mean, $20,000, I think might be it's like poverty level for a family, is it somewhere around there? So we basically spent a family's earnings on healthcare that year. I mean that, so I'm just trying to say that it was significant. It was a significant amount of money. Thank God we had the money to do it. But yeah, and that's how my doll journey began. I started selling dolls because I said, I gotta try to figure out a way to bring some money in. I can't go to work because this kid needs to go to doctor's appointments. And some weeks my baby was going to doctor's appointments. They have 5 to 7 appointments a week. You can't go to work and take somebody to a doctor's appointment because, with the medical system we have, and maybe this is how medicine works everywhere, I don't know, but doctors don't run on time. And that's probably a blessing because somebody needs more time than the next person. So your appointment's at 2 o'clock and the doctor doesn't see you till 4. So when you're in that kind of situation, you don't have the same management. You don't have the same control over your time. So you can't go to work when you're doing that kind of thing. So I started selling dolls. So that's part of my doll journey. Now, my kid in, let me see, 2019 was significant for us. That was twin. The pandemic kicked off in the beginning of 2019. So 2018 then was that significant year. We traveled back east, and this is, I went back with my child who has a chronic pain condition. And while we were there, we spent time with some family, friends who are like family. I've known them since we went to university together, so we've known each other since we were teens. And their children have some conditions like Lyme's and Ehlers-Danlos, some of those kinds of things. And they asked if my kid had been tested for them, and my kid had not. So we come home, we have this kid tested, and life-changing things happen. We find that the kid has Ehlers-Danlos, and the type of Ehlers-Danlos that they have is, it's hypermobility, so they can't really treat hypermobility. What they do is, if so, like with my kid, as they get older, there will be more issues with their connective tissue, and their joints will be more likely to, what do you call it, dislocate. So they may at some point have to wear some kind of braces or whatever to hold things in place. So, and the other thing that we found out was that my kid had POTS, and POTS is a, it's a heart issue. And what happens is your body doesn't move your blood outside of your torso. I shouldn't say it doesn't, because it does, but not effectively. So this kid was always tired. Just always tired. And so they were tired and they were hurting, and we could not. So, I had to homeschool. They couldn't, because they couldn't go to school. And I saw them. This kid's first word was book. This kid loved books. Kid loves books. And it was really interesting to watch this child who literally started reading around 2. I know that that doesn't sound right. At 18 months, this kid started saying, point the word, when we read two of them. And so during their second year, I said, we've been doing enough reading with them. It's time to start teaching them, to read themselves. So I said, I opened a book and I said, what's this word? And it was like, dog. I was like, So I get another book. What's this word? Bird. I mean, just the kid just knew these words. I was like, okay, this kid must have memorized the pages in the books. So I go to a word chart and I say, what's this word? And I'm pointing to like colors. This kid's like orange, purple. It's like, how do you know? Those are hard words. And so my little 2-year-old kid can read. And it's like, okay. And the other thing is, like, with this word chart, it wasn't like purple was in purple. it was all of the words were in black. So the reason that this is significant is I watched this child who devoured books and language get to a point where they couldn't read anymore for themselves. Then they couldn't comprehend when they were read to. So it was like some huge part of their body, like maybe being paralyzed or something would be the only way I could say physically how that would happen, because that kid read. And to not only not be able to read, to not be able to comprehend when you were read to, was really heavy. So that kid's last full year of school was fourth grade. And they went to fifth grade for a little bit, I think a semester. Then they went to middle school for a semester. I think that was seventh grade. And again, it just, not being able to fully pull things. They were in a wheelchair because of the pain, and it was devastating. I mean, it was devastating. And they wanted to be an astronaut. And I remember having a conversation with my kid, because they're very sensitive to cold. And I remember my kid saying, I can't be an astronaut. Because when you look at the training, a lot of the training is in swimming pools. I can't be in the cold water. And there's just sadness and grief with that. So this kid, turns 18, and we all know what we're going to do, because what do you do with someone who has officially has a fourth grade education? Now, thank God my kid had a very strong education early on, and we were able to teach them some things, and then they would find things that they would be really interested in, a lot of history. And so they learned some things on their own. And so we did that. And the significance of the trip was, once this POTS was treated, my kid was able to read. And so it was really interesting to see how it was impacting our house, because anyone who, we walk past this kid and it's like, ooh, you're reading. And this kid would say, don't get too excited about this, because I have times when I can do things. And then they go away. And so we were really excited, but we had seen it before. We had seen these bright, brilliant times. This kid is flourishing. And then the next day, the kid's down. So that was, it was hard. So when we go and we, so now my kid is treated for POTS. And starts feeling better. The pain has not gone away. They've learned how to manage the pain and how to deal with the pain. But they've gone from existing as a person who you would probably, I mean, like the first descriptor would be a sufferer from of chronic pain because it impacted every aspect of their life. To, a young person who was starting to do these things. So one day this kid says, "I want to go to, I want to go to college." It's like, okay. So how are we going to do this? And because we got to get you something that says that you can do high school. And so my kid's really worried. Oh, I don't know if I can pass this GED test. And it's like, just go, let's just, I think you can pass the GED test. Let's just have you take a test, you cut like a sample test and see how well you do. And then if you do well, you take the test. Kid does extremely well. Thought we, we were not surprised about that. And then, so the kid gets, my kid gets a high school diploma. Here you can get a high school diploma or a GED. So they got the high school diploma option and got accepted into and to art school. They want to be a concept artist. And so they started university over during COVID. They are now a sophomore and they've never been on campus. So it's really freaky because one of the things about university, at least for me and my experience, was I got to stop being my grandmother's granddaughter. My grandmother was my primary caretaker. So I went to this other country. Nobody knew my people. I got to be anybody I wanted to. I got to, I mean, it was just, I got to be me. I got to define myself without this outside influence. And so I've been really excited about my children having the same experience. And this little one is like, my husband and I, our conversations have been about, should we buy a duplex so that they can have a place to live and have their own space and independence, but live next door to us so that when they need stuff, we can be there for them. And so we've gone from that to this kid is flourishing. It's going to be in a few weeks moving to San Francisco for university. So that's brilliant. I mean, we're just like super, super excited. So that's been, I hope I answered the what you said at that. So that's been our experience with medical system. And again, we have, because we do have insurance and we have decent insurance, my husband makes enough money that we have been able to, we were able to successfully create a space for our child to have a life. If those things had been different, I don't know how we would have done it. I don't know how you send a child to school who is in so much pain that they have to be in a wheelchair. I don't know how that works. I don't know if you don't have health insurance, and a lot of people in this country don't. I don't know how you deal with your child crying. And I mean, I take my kid to the emergency room, they give us Tylenol with codeine. And my kid would come home and would like be watching TV. My kid would be laughing and in pain. The coat they would be high. So yeah, I'm sorry for the American healthcare system. I think that as a people, we deserve better. Okay, we'll get into something else.
Do you remember when you first heard about COVID-19?
Yeah, I told you that earlier with, I heard about it and it was like, watching people buying up toilet paper and it's like, what is this? This is really some kind of show right here. So yeah, it was, it's really funny. I think I might have said this before, to COVID time. Sometimes it feels like COVID started yesterday, and sometimes it feels like COVID started 50 years ago. It's so slow, and then you asked me to tell you a story, and I'm bouncing around again. And this is about COVID. My next door neighbor had a baby. Now, we would see the baby from a distance when they were walking. But one day we have a wall, it's a concrete brick wall between our properties. And so they, kind of sat the baby up on the wall. And, we were probably 12 feet back and looking at the baby and whatever. And our neighbor says, oh, yeah, we had invited some people over. And I think it was like six babies. And they were all like around 6 months old. And none of them had ever seen a baby before. It's like, oh my goodness. It's this COVID time. My kids refer to the time before COVID as in the before times. So you asked me if I remember. Yes.
What was your day-to-day looking like in the before times?
My day-to-day has not honestly changed that much. I am a spoiled brat here. That is mostly true. But I did go out and do some shopping and that kind of thing. Because since COVID, I mean, like I said, when the governor said you should have one person, we still live pretty much like early COVID. And now my oldest child, she has moved out into her own space on campus. She's here in town going to university. My baby is here. And so my baby goes out more than the rest of us do. And, there are the pros and cons on that. How do you keep a 20-year-old person at home, especially a 20-year-old person who stopped really having much interaction with people at like fifth grade because they went to school halfway through fifth, they did half of fifth grade, half of seventh grade. It's like, how do you tell this person now stay in the house? So they are going out more and they're wearing, their masks. I was out more. I did more interactions with friends, and but I still I'm just, I guess I'm a homebody. I've always spent a good amount of time at home, but I did spend more time with friends. And I did, you know what else I did that I have? It's really funny. I guess I hadn't thought about this. I used to volunteer a lot. And I haven't been volunteering. I volunteered with, well, with a number of organizations, most recently with a group of people who work with immigrants and refugees. So you have these people who are coming into the country from refugee camps. And that's a whole nother thing, man. If you guys are looking for, like, if you want to be capturing oral history, that's a brilliant place to stop and park because you've got these people coming in, and a lot of them don't speak the language. So you've got the barriers. And then it's like, what happens to them when they come into the country? How the country treats them is its own thing. And then if you just sit and talk to one of them, if you have someone who can speak English, I talked to this guy. He told me that. He asked me where I was from, and I said, I'm from America. And he says, no, where are you from? And I said, I was born in, Denver, Colorado. I'm from Denver, Colorado. He's like, so your parents moved to America from Africa and then you were born here? I said, no, my parents are American. He's like, so when did you come from Africa? You didn't come as a little kid? You said you were born here. Did your parents come as little kids? I mean, he was just really confused. And I'm like, what is going on? What are we? And I said, look, my African ancestors have been in this country since at least the late 1700s. He's like, oh, it's like you're an American. Yeah. And my native people, you start talking to native people and they'll tell you, came up out of the ground, Sipa pools, we've been here. So my people been here. I'm American, whatever that means. And he says, oh, he says, well, I came here from, I think from the Congo. He says, I was in a refugee camp. He said, I was in that refugee camp for 20 years. But I was in another refugee camp for 20 years. And it's like, this man, I don't know how old he was. He looked, I mean, he looked like he was in his 40s. So I mean, I don't know if he was really 40, 60. I don't know. But I was thinking, this man has spent his life in refugee camps, And so that's really interesting. If you guys ever decide to do something like that, I can hook you up with some people because there's some, oh, there's some interesting stories there that should be, I think, should be captured and should help us to better understand where we are, especially like 20 years from now, because it seems like they have been coming here in large enough numbers that I've been, seeing them in like maybe the last, I'm gonna say decade, but I think it's been less than that. And how their being here impacts our country needs to be part of our oral history. That needs to be there. How they came and how they are impacting the country and how the country is impacting them. So, sorry. That I know I veered off on that
You're still doing perfect. There is no veering off.
Okay.
What's motherhood meant to you?
Wow. That's a really good question. So I was raised by my grandmother. And I think so much of motherhood has been about grandmotherhood because of my relationship with my grandmother. My grandmother was like, she was the backbone of my family. And because I grew up in her home, I got to see how these generations of people interacted with each other. My family moved from my, so my, one of my uncles was in the military. He got stationed in Colorado. Another one of my uncles was really close with that uncle, so then he moved to Colorado. They moved there from Hayti, Missouri to Denver, Colorado. So then one of my uncles was, had, I don't know, some emotional, mental kind of issues. He was in a hospital. So they sent for him because they thought that he would get better care. So then they sent for my grandmother and my aunt and my mother. They were my grandmother's youngest two children. So what ended up happening is most of my grandmother's descendants ended up in Denver. And so, I had cousins and I mean, we just had people around. You, at my house, you would go to bed in your own bed and you'd wake up and your cousin would be there. Or someone, we live in a lower income inner city housing project. So there's lots of younger people in there having, with children. So we all were like cousins. And so between my biological cousins and my neighbor cousins, you go to bed by yourself, you wake up and then your cousin's in bed with you. You go to bed with your cousin and you wake up and your cousin's gone because your cousin's mom came and got him. So I had this really interactive house where people were in and out all the time. So for me, I guess it's that whole thing about children being tomorrow, and your children being your grandparents, your children being the parents of your grandchildren. I mean, your children being the parents of your grandchildren. What's really interesting, though, is as we look at the world and what's happening, I'm seeing more children not wanting to have children. Both of my children are saying that they're not going to have children. So that whole thing about, looking forward to be a grandparent and all that kind of thing is, I'm having to reset that. And I'm not angry. I mean, I'm sad in that we are living during a time where people are saying we are doing so much harm to this planet that I don't want to continue to add harm to it. And I don't want to have children who end up in situations where the difference between the haves and the have-nots is who has water, or something like that. So that's really hard. But I've loved being a mother. Yeah, I love my children, and it's been an interesting journey, and I think I have learned at least as much from them and continue to learn at least as much from them as they learned from me. I learned so much about myself, and just it's really interesting to love someone so much that you would really, literally give your life up for them. To say I've lived long enough, and if I were to die today and they could continue on, yeah, I would give up mine for them. I love my children. And again, you go back and you look, so much of my experience is that of a Black woman. And I think that often people don't. I think if you are not part of a minority group, you don't understand how much of being a minority, how much of that is part of your identity. So, as a Black female, especially growing up without, growing up impoverished, feels like the only thing you have is your children. And so that link then is really, it's really something. And it's fascinating to give birth to a child. And it's not necessarily the whole birth process. That's real quickly. But to have something growing and living inside your body and moving around, oh my goodness. That I think that being pregnant is the closest we get to God, that whole creation. And then having that child and how you feel for it is as close as we, in our limited minds and experiences, can get to God. Yeah. Yeah, motherhood's a blessing. Sorry. I'm really enjoying this. It's like I'm thinking, it's like, oh, I didn't know I felt that way about that.
The last few years have had so much going on that weren't just the pandemic. I'm wondering, other than COVID-19, what have been some of the social and political issues on your mind?
Oh boy. So I guess we'll go back again to the whole minority thing. I think that as a country, we are starting to look beyond the space of white people. And so our history is a history of white people in this country. We don't really talk that much about Black people. We talk about Dr. King and maybe Sojourner Truth and some Frederick Douglass, but not too many more people than that. Same way with Native people. We don't really talk about Native people. We don't talk about Cesar Chavez and the Hispanic movements and, what happened with Che and Cuba. And our history, as I say, the victor tells his story. And so we hear his story. And we are opening up and we are starting to be more open to others' stories. And I think that it's becoming a good thing. Ask me the question again.
The last couple
Oh,
of years
go
have
ahead.
been so much more than just the pandemic. What are some of the other political and social issues that have been on your mind?
Okay, thank you. Because I was thinking I was way off point. It's like I'm way somewhere else and come back. So, one of the things that I've seen some research go into has been how women are faring during and after birth. And we're seeing numbers like Black women are dying, are 4 times more likely to die from, pregnancy, postpartum kind of things. We're four times more likely to die than white women. And the numbers are really interesting when you look at, we were talking earlier about the refugees, immigrants. Black women who are coming from other countries, their numbers look more like white women's numbers. But their children's numbers look like Black people's numbers. So what's happening in this country that is making it so hard for Black women to have children? And why do we see this change? Why do we see this change with people who just, if it was just because we're all Black, if you came here from Nigeria, you should be having the same death rates as I have, but you don't. And then we've seen, the Black Lives Matter movement and that's been pretty hard. One of my children said to me, because one of my children is an activist, one of my kids is in the LGBTQ plus space and has it's very active. And my children are also biracial. And it's interesting to have discussions with this kid because this kid says, I understand that if I were to straighten my hair, I would look like I was a different race. I would not look Black. And if I moved someplace where there wasn't as much sun, I would be white passing. And I understand that there's a privilege in that. And so we've had some discussions about there were, for a while, there were people being hanged. They just find this person's body hanging, and can't remember what it was. It was like three young men in a short amount of time during the Black Lives Matter were hanged. And they're saying, oh, they committed suicide. Okay, why are they hanging themselves to commit suicide? What is this? Why are people? And so my kid said to me, Mom, I'm an activist. I said, yeah. Mom, they could kill me. Somebody could come and hang me. One of the hardest things about that conversation was I couldn't say, oh, no, not you. I couldn't say, not you. All I could tell my kid was, the chances of that happening to you are very slim. The chances of that happening to any one person is very slim. And I'm sorry that, we are experiencing this. I'm sorry that they've experienced this. I'm sorry that. I said, but it's very slim. I don't see that as, I don't think that that's something that you like really, really, really need to be concerned about. Like I said, I think for any one person. But that was hard. That's hard. I couldn't say, I mean, I guess I could have said, oh, it won't happen to you, but I don't lie to my children. And there was something in that discussion where, and even for myself, it's like, yeah, my kid could be hanged. I could be hanged. Right now, they're not using the term serial killer. But we have someone in Albuquerque, some people, some group, I don't know, who appear to be targeting Middle Eastern men or Muslim. That's what they have had in common. They're Middle Eastern and they're Muslim. And since November, they've killed three of them. And so they seem that the police is now saying that there is some pattern. They believe that all of these deaths are associated with each other because they just seem like just random acts of violence. And that's scary to think that there is somebody out there targeting. Because of the way they look or they worship. The last one is 27 years old. 27-year-old guy. Don't know if he was elected, appointed into one of the smaller adjacent, cities to ours. And he was going to be moving into housing there. They got housing for him there. He was living in this. I have a kid who's down by campus. He was living down by campus, and he apparently went outside to talk on the phone. He lived in the house with his brother and his brother's children. I don't know if there was like the mom of the kid. I don't, but at least that's who was in, at least those people were in the house. And the brother thought he went out to, just call home because they're, from the Middle East. And he realized he'd been gone for like hours. So he calls the police and he says, hey, my brother's missing. And then they're like, no, your brother's dead. It's scary. It's scary. And it feels like, so we got COVID. Now they talk about monkeypox. Just feels like it just piles on. We got Breonna Taylor, who was killed by the police, and they said they went to the wrong household. And she ended up dead. We had a, can't think of his name, a young man who was jogging, and these people killed him, a young black man. He was just jogging. And it just, George Floyd, Sandra Bland. It's really hard. And some really, and then we got the school shootings. Oh, you don't know how happy I am that my children are not. Whoo, Lord have mercy. I can't imagine being somebody with a little kid and your little kid has to go to school because you got to go to work. And again, it's the whole thing with the chances of something happening to you are slim. Think about how many schools there are in America. You're good. The chance of something happening to you. Except it happens to people. It happens to people. I remember when Obama was running for president. That's when I started seeing a big change in America. We know people are racist, and that's just part of our history, and that's how we interact with each other or don't or whatever. And even when if we're trying not to be, you have to work really hard in a society because it is just set up. And but when we look at it though, it's set up for all of us to not be successful, or most of us. I mean, look at the beauty standards. They finally have given Barbie a doll that's a body that's like human-ish in proportion. People trying to look like Barbie, and Barbie would look like a monster if she were a human. So we have these non-human standards for beauty, and so we all of us are living in some kind of world that says I'm lesser than. And I think that that has a lot to do with how we then interact with each other, because nobody wants to be at the bottom. So at least I'm not a woman. At least I'm not black. At least I'm not Jewish. At least I'm not Muslim. At least I'm not a child. At least I'm not an old person. At least I'm not handicapped. At least I can see. We're all living in a space that says that there is some person who is all things, and we, none of us as individuals, can be that thing. And I think that that then helps to spark all of this other stuff that happens, the racism, the sexism, because we have that mark there that we're all striving to get to. But I'll go back to when Obama was running. I never saw racism in America like that. I had seen some racism in Britain that was like wild and crazy. And I kind of got an appreciation for it because you knew who was doing what. This dude over here, he's with the National Front. Look how he's dressed. Don't mess with him, and he won't mess with you, and everybody's good. But in America, everybody, they're quiet, he's speaking, and they're quiet. And that's what they say when they're together, and they tell those jokes, and they do that. And then when Obama ran, it wasn't quiet anymore. And so my kids were in this Brownies group and Girl Scout. Are they brown? I don't know, some Girl Scout brownie, some of them little ones. And the group leader had to contact the parents. What she told us was, what her apology was, I'm really sorry that the girls are talking about Obama eating babies. I'm sorry that that's the discussion, and we need to. I'm sorry if your kids have heard that or whatever. And if your kids are saying that, you need to tell them not. We need to have discussions with our kids. So I talked to my kids. I was like, y'all hearing something about Obama eating some babies? No. So okay, so they knew enough to understand not to tell the black kids that. And so I told my kids, this is a really crazy time. People are really like geared up for this election. I want you to understand, I need you to believe, because I need to believe this, that the people in this country are concerned and intelligent enough to elect somebody who will make the best decisions for us. You don't have to worry about that. That's what the grown people are doing. That's what we have to believe, that en masse, that's what's going to happen. We are not going to elect a baby eater. You don't have to be worried. So if you're hearing any kind of crazy stories, That's somebody's fear. That's not yours. And my kids went to a little alternative school. And it was part homeschool and part school. And they did a lot of things. Like they had, you know, elections in the past where you could vote and your kids would say, oh, I'm going to vote for this one and vote for that one. People were so wound up, they couldn't do the election. They could not do the elections. They had to stop a class one day because they were reading something, and I think it was like Black History. And one of the children said, I hope Obama is assassinated. It's like, where'd that come from? Why are elementary school kids talking about Obama being assassinated? Why you got to stop the little kids' class because some kid's talking about he wants Obama to be assassinated? What are y'all talking about? I never seen the anger. The anger. And just watching people, you know, Facebook, you know, you can't be my friend. I'm not going to be your friend. You're not going to be my friend. It's like, we're not going to be friends with you. I had someone who I thought I was really good friends with, you know, parents at school. And we were doing something. The kids were going, you know, doing something. The parents were there for the event. This guy, so there was me, and there was another couple. And this guy, I don't think his wife was with him. She might be, I don't know, it's not significant. He walks up to me and he says, because I think it was a couple and me, and then he came over. And he says, you would have to be crazy to vote for Obama. It's like, how do you start a conversation like that? We're talking about whatever we're talking about, you don't even know, and it ain't about Obama. You just walk over here and just say you had to be crazy. What are you, get out of here. I had never seen, I mean, and I didn't think that people that I knew would do that. I thought that those were all other people. I don't know who these other people were, but I didn't know them. And then we get Trump run for president, and Lord have mercy. I mean, I honestly, if my children weren't here and doing university and my husband, you know, if we could just like walk, I don't know that we'd be here. I'm sick and tired of America. I am sick and tired of America. And maybe the worst thing to do is leave. Maybe we need to stay here and fight this battle. I don't know. But I'm sick and tired of America. I'm tired of people saying hateful things about each other, doing hateful things to each other. You can't trust the police because the police did this. And it's just like, who do we trust? Well, you know, you need to have a good guy in the room with a gun, a good guy in the room to protect everybody else. Why do we need to be carrying guns? We're broken. America's broken. And the gun lobbyists have too much money and control. And it's like these people who are hateful have infiltrated like every aspect of the country. So you cannot just assume that somebody who is in the leadership power or who is a police officer or whatever, you can't assume they're doing the right things. I just heard something about these three police officers, I can't remember where they were, but they, I think they had to let all three of them go. They were having a conversation about Black people and about, you know, what they were, it was like they were actively, it's like we should actively do things to them, like we should kill them. It's like, why are you a police officer? What are you doing? Why, you just randomly want to just kill people? Because of the color of their skin? I don't know. Just crazy. We were talking about movement. It's just. And you know what? Maybe all of this is a good thing because if we did not have these bad things that happened, and now we've got like the internet. I mean, you can get, news within minutes. If we did not have the internet, if we did not have people with cell phones, I think a lot of these things that are happening, people will be saying, no, they're making stuff up. So maybe it's good that we're having this, because maybe it's we're turning stuff up from, the bottom, we're turning this trash over, and we can clear some of this stuff out and air some of this stuff out so that it's better for everybody. But Lord knows it is hard right now. This is hard. This is hard. Just hard. And, it's sad, it's the truth that I'm really happy I don't have any sons. I can't imagine being the mother of a black male in this country right now. We are all having to deal with some stuff, but oh Lord, it seems like black men, they are not getting a break. I cannot imagine. Because like I said, my kids are at the age where you want them to be able to just go fly and soar and do their own gig, and whoo, I would be afraid for my son. Not that I'm not afraid for my children, but not like for a son. That would be scary. Yeah. Okay. I keep taking us down these dark paths. It's like, I'll tell you something good. Maybe it's all good.
What does the word health mean to you?
Oh, I'm liking you guys' questions. Health. So I think of, I was going to say people, but I think of all living things as having a connection. And so for me, health is, the ability to find peace and joy. And it's not just about the body, because you could have a body that if you ran it through tests, the body is, pretty perfect. Everything is where it should be, working the way that we expect it to work. And you could be miserable. So that, I wouldn't say that that was healthy. I would actually say somebody who was happy with a body that functioned, I don't know how we would describe it, in a way that's not, oh God, I was gonna say normal. What is normal? But you know what? And it was a body that with a body that is at dis-ease. How about that? I would think that a person who was happy living in a body that is at dis-ease is actually healthier than somebody whose body is not at dis-ease. So it's about being able to make your own choices, being free and happy, and yeah, being able to experience some good things. That's how I would define health.
What are some of the things you want for your own health and the health of people around you? And how do you think we build a world where it would be possible to attain those things?
Cool. Okay, so what are the things that I, let's break it down. Tell them to me again.
What are some of the things you want for your own health and the health of people around you?
So, So for me, I want to get to a point where I am living more with intention. I have gotten to a point where I do a lot of comfort eating. So I need to be more conscious and thoughtful. Yeah, more thoughtful. And so what would I want for me and for the people who around me? But that's the kind of thing that I would want. You know what also I would want, as far as if we're going to go into health, I would love to see it if we have free health care. If everybody, not just the people around me, had free health care. Nobody in this country should be, I don't think we should be hungry. I don't think we should be undereducated or experiencing like body, negative body issues, the dis-ease. We have so much money here. It's sad that we have all this money, but the money's not going to the people. So that's what I would like to see. I would like to see mental health care, just free gyms so that people could go and work out. I would like to see, we have so many stores in America are throwing out food, stores and restaurants. I would like to see that food going to those in need. You know, here, if you, at least at the store by me, I don't know if every store in the city is doing this or not, every grocery store, but at the grocery store in my neighborhood, they have free fruit. And anybody can have the fruit. Just go in there and eat it. And I don't know, I had a conversation with a manager one night. I don't know if that had anything to do with it or not. I was in the store and three young men were in there. I shouldn't say, they were boys. And I don't think any of them were teenagers. I think they were like maybe 8 to 11, or they were young, and they were eating out of the bulk food containers. And so I said to them, technically what you guys are doing is stealing. I said, you guys don't want to get in trouble for stealing. I said, I'm assuming that you're hungry and that's why you're doing what you're doing. I said, are you hungry? And the little one said, yes. The other one said, no, no, we're not hungry, no, no. Well, the little one said, I am. I said, okay, come on, little man. I said, let's go over here because they have these like pre-made lunches. This is like a sandwich and a piece of fruit and maybe some cookies and a little kiddie drink. I said, okay, come over here. Let's go over here and let's get you one of these right here. You choose whichever one you want. So he chooses the one he wants. So I tell the bigger boys, if you're hungry, I will buy you something to eat. All you have to do is just choose what you eat, because I don't, you know, feel like I should make you eat something. I think you should eat what you want to eat. So just pick yourself out one. I'm not hungry. I'm not hungry. I said, look, you're in here eating out the bins, you're going to get in trouble. You apparently are hungry. I'm not hungry. I'm not. Okay. So the little boy says, I'm not giving you my food because I'm hungry. So I buy food for the little one and I talk to the manager and I say, hey, I'm really concerned. There's children in here and they're eating out the bins. And I think we need to figure out some way for these kids to eat. They should not be getting in trouble because they're hungry. And it wasn't much longer from that time to when they started giving out free fruit. So I don't know if they are connected or not. So again, you could go into the produce area. They got free fruit. And I talked to the guy in the produce area and I told him, I thought that was amazing. That's great. You know, nobody should be hungry and it's healthy food. And He said, yeah. He says, and the other thing is, you know, and he says, it also helps us as a store because a lot of people end up leaving because, you know, they had picked their kids up from school and whatever, and their kids are tired and they're crying. So they end up leaving the store early. So if we can give the kids something to eat, then it keeps that blood level. And he says, you know, I've had people like, they go up to the front and they have a whole bunch of the free fruit. And so the front calls me and says, he's like, there's somebody up here with 10 bananas. He says, I just say give it to them. We have enough bananas that everybody can have some bananas. And another thing that I've noticed that they do, it seems like when they have a plethora of food, like let's say they got a lot of zucchini in, they'll put zucchini in like a little, that's like a little netted bags, like where you get oranges, something like that. And they have them in a certain area and they'll have them marked down. But they're not like old. I mean, if you go and look at them, they're just like zucchini. So I don't ever shop from there because I don't feel like that's for me. I feel like they're that's for people who can't afford to pay. I don't know what zucchini costs. I just go in the store and buy them. So whatever zucchini costs, because you know it's not like you're buying steak. You know, and I think that the country and the world would be a lot better off if we lived that way. So that those of us who it goes back to like taxes. If everybody was taxed in a way that was based upon their real money, we'd have a different country because we could then afford health care for everybody. America wouldn't be way down on the list when it comes to education. We could have some of the best education in the world. I mean, Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Warren Buffett got enough money between the three of them to take care of the rest of us. You know, Oprah got billion, Robert Smith got billion, and yeah, tax people the way they should be taxed so that the rest of us can live, so that people aren't living in food deserts. That's another one. It's like, oh my God. Yeah. Okay.
How do you think we make that version of health accessible to everyone? What do we need to change as a society so that we make those changes that you want to see made? How do we get there?
I really think that the way we get there is through our children. We need to start teaching our children that we are responsible for our brother. So hopefully by teaching children that, you know, that we bear some responsibility. When they get to be older, they will be more willing to help. So I live in a city where we've got a good number of homeless people. Apparently, you know, that's part of the whole COVID thing. There's a lot more homeless people. People lost jobs and whatever. And so they've been talking about, you know, what do we do with all these homeless people? Where do they live? And so they're talking about doing some encampments. Oh, no, not in my neighborhood. Not in my park. They can't live up in my park in a tent. And it's just like, oh my God, where are they supposed to live? Everybody's saying, no, you can't live in my neighborhood in a tent. Where are they supposed to live? If we all took some responsibility and said, it is on us to make sure that everybody has food, everybody has a place to live, it would be very different. And the only, it seems like, and maybe I have some ignorant childlike view of the government, but it just seems like the government would be where these things would happen because that's where the money funnels to. So maybe we could set up some nonprofit organizations or something that got money from the government and they were in, cities and whatever, so that we could see this money being dispersed out to those in need and not like just in some big place. Okay, here. In Britain, you can get other things at the post office. Like, I remember when I was in uni, people went there and they got, I don't know, you must get some kind of form because I didn't get it. But some kind of way, their glasses had something to do with the post office. So what if, because we've got post offices all over the cities, this is a real common thing. What if the post offices had a, I don't know, some, you could go to the post office and get a voucher for free food, or maybe we paid the stores so that people could come in and get certain things. I don't know. Maybe instead of stores throwing away things, throwing away food, why can't we give it to some other organizations? I remember being a kid. There was this Payless shoe store that was, that's where we would go and buy shoes. And they would take a box cutter and they would cut shoes, put them in the trash. What would you put, t put a box, cut the shoes up and put them in the trash? Why would you? I mean, it's like, I don't understand. It would make more sense to give the shoes to the Goodwill. Maybe you don't want people to come in there getting your free shoes from your store for free. I mean, I don't know, but all of this stuff, I think it starts with the kids. We are all responsible, and we can all live better if we see ourselves as being partially responsible. I have seen a change in my neighborhood. I live in a more affluent neighborhood. My next door neighbor, she's moved, they've moved, but I used to live next door to a doctor, and across the street was a dentist. And so, lawyers, that's engineers, that's where I live. Okay. So when the economy changes, my comfort changes. So when the economy is bad, people come to my neighborhood. So I live in a neighborhood now where most of us have locked mailboxes. When I moved here, we didn't have locked mailboxes. A good percentage of us have ring, I don't, well, I'm at home all the time, but a good percentage of us have ring doorbell things so you can see who's on your front porch. We could all live better if we all lived better. And I think that if you were somebody who has more money than you could spend in 100 lifetimes, because that's what we're talking about, these people and their money, you should be able to live very well on your money and help other people. So teach children that we're responsible for each other, that we should, that it, and even if we have to do it in a selfish way, you live better if I live better. Your mail is okay if I have enough money to feed myself. I should not have to be preying upon other people because I don't have. Nor should I be sitting at home starving because I'm not going to commit a crime. So, yeah, I think it starts with our kids.
What does the word safety mean to you?
Safe means the ability to be free and happy. To not, so it's, I guess that's the way I would define it. And then if I had to go back and say what it is not, is it is not, it's not fear. It is not, yeah, I think I'm gonna say it's not fear. It's just the ability to just exist and to be, as long as I'm not harming anybody else, and be happy and free. You should not be fearful to go certain places, or like as women, there are places like that. It's not good for us to be out at night alone. That kind of thing. Safety is just being able. It's like that, to have that, to live with the innocence of a child, to not have to be worried about things. And I know people, I couldn't teach my kids this, but I know people try to teach their kids Stranger Danger. My kids didn't do Stranger Danger. They could not comprehend that somebody was trying to do something to them. That's the way, that's safety, that's health. Yeah.
There's been this really tiny, narrow definition of safety or ideas of what is safe under the confines of COVID, so how one keeps themselves safe from a virus. In that teeny, tiny microcosm, what are some of the things that you've been doing to keep yourself feeling safer?
Well, I guess the first thing when we're talking about physically has been trying to stick to the mandates that the governor gave. Trying not to spend a lot of time with other people. You're trying to stay close to home and to not interact with very many people. So that's been the first thing. The next thing has been, and maybe I should have answered this earlier, but it falls into here too. I hadn't thought about it. There are medical things that I have not done. It's not that I'm sick, like I haven't had a mammogram in a while. Those preventative care. It's like, yeah, I could go and get a mammogram and I could get COVID. Well, I'm not, I probably am not, in need of a mammogram. I don't think I have breast cancer. But those are the kind of things, like I didn't get my teeth cleaned as often. It's like, I'm not going someplace and taking my mask off. So it's like I'll have to have stinky teeth or whatever until I cannot have stinky teeth. Just that kind of the maintenance, that's it. The physical maintenance. Because even with glasses, I was like, I don't need to be up in people's faces. No, I don't need any glasses. I'm good. I'm good. So that's happened. Another thing is I've had to learn to develop support systems in a different way. So, like, I joined a group where we have writing prompts and we, write about, things that are going on, and it's very helpful. Like, one of the recent writing prompts that really like touched me was, what is your morning routine? Is it healthy? And if it's not, what can you do to make it healthy? Just those kinds of things to just really think about what's going on. I love having that support group. And so it's a group of people who, not related, who all come together and we all love and uplift each other. So I've had to do things like that, go online to find family. Also through in the doll world, and having these people from around the world, I've got this support group. I am seeing a therapist, and I'm seeing my therapist online. And so I have that too. So, and I have friends from every point of my life who are still part of my life. Like I can say, oh, I've known this person. I met them when I was in elementary school, and we're still friends. I met this one in middle school, and we're still friends. And I met this one, I have friends around the world with the people I went to uni with in Britain. I still have relationships with them. So a lot of my health support kind of has been just in some ways honing in, moving in deeper with those who I knew, and then expanding out to find like-minded people. So I think I answered that.
How are you feeling about the immediate future?
Oh, I wish you hadn't asked me that question today. Gonna be honest with you. I am afraid. I am excited. I'm afraid because I told you, and it's a running joke. I've been on maternity leave for 23 years. My baby's going to university. I don't know what I look like without a kid. I don't know what that means. I don't know what life is without a kid. The last 22 years of my life, 23 years of my life, I've been an incubator for a baby, or milk maker, or a teacher, a comforter. My life has been about babies. So as an artist, I go by the name Tej. And so I had my kids with me. They were little, they weren't in school yet. And so we'd go and we'd be hanging shows, and I'd have them with me. And I called myself Tej Party of Three because my kids were always there with me. So I don't know. And like I told you, I left in the doll world, so I got to figure out what does this mean, as this person who is this doll expert, to get this show started and leave. And so what do I do next? And th there's a part of me that feels like I need to just, like, because I know my kid's leaving in a few weeks, I feel like I need to fill up all my time. But I need to not. I need to take some time to just think about thinking and to just sit. And I've got a whining dog. Let me let my dog out. And to just try to figure out who Tammy is, what Tammy likes to do, and do some of that. Okay, here you go, Doug. You going out? See how long he stays out. My dog is always on the wrong side of the door. He opened the door, you let him out. He's like, oh yeah, now I'm on the right side. He turns around and looks, he's like, hey, I'm on the side of the door. So, sorry, I digress. So yeah, for me, I think, so I am afraid, but I am also excited. I'm excited to get back to being, I said not back to, but being an empty nester. I mean, I miss my husband. I adore my husband, and I'm excited about just hanging with my husband. I'm excited to see what I'm going to do. I've been doing some things. I've been getting back into art. I've been sculpting dolls. So I'm excited about my creativity. There's also this. We were talking earlier about things, and I was telling you about being a grandparent. Well, my kids are saying that they're not going to have kids. I don't know. They might not. There's a freedom in them not having kids. There's this burden. God, I don't know that I don't want it to sound like a horrible burden. But I think for most of us who have children, we want to live in a manner that when we leave them with something. And if my children don't have children, I don't have to be concerned with leaving my grandchildren something. Not that I shouldn't leave my children anything, but it's different when you have to be responsible for you, as opposed to you having to be responsible for children. So if they have no children, when we die, what we have goes to our children. And we don't have to say, oh, we have to, let's be thinking about what we're leaving to little Timmy. No, there's no little Timmy. And the same thing with our kids. So when they get whatever we leave, they don't have to worry about leaving something for little Timmy. So they can go and hopefully do something that they really want to do. And that's pretty cool. That's cool. It's cool to have grandkids too, but that's one of those where all endings sound good. Took me a while to get there, but I'm excited about however it works out. I'm good. Yeah.
Has your relationship with your dog changed at all during the pandemic?
My dog. That's interesting. So, okay. From the vantage point of me and my dog, not really, because we've been hanging here. We've had our dog for 14 years. So that's my dog. So he still comes and talks to me and tells me like when he wants to eat or whatever. Now, from the vantage point of my family, I think his relationship with the family has changed because everybody's here now. My husband has gone back to work and my oldest daughter's moved out, but that's, recently. My oldest daughter moved out in June, and my husband, when did he go back to work? I can't remember when he went back to work. Just it's been like the last 3 months. So their relationships with him have changed, where they're having to do more. I guess for me, I guess I'm not having to feed him as much. There are more people around, so if he wants to go outside, I don't have to do that. So I guess it's been less, I don't know if the right term was burdensome, but I have had less responsibilities with him. It's been more of a shared responsibility with them being home. So I think that that's a fair way of describing it.
Has your relationship to touch changed at all over the course of the pandemic?
That's a good question. That is a really good question because it keeps making me think. I don't know. And the reason that I don't know is that I tend to be in the house. So I have to think about when I am outside because that's where Yeah, it has probably changed because I'm a hu it has changed. Let me tell you what happened. I took my kid went and changed their name recently. And so I was out, there was this lady outside the building, she's picking up rocks. And I'm like, why is a lady picking up rocks? So when I asked, I was like, why are you picking up rocks? And she said, oh, I'm picking up rocks because I'm an artist and I use rocks in my art. I was like, oh, that's cool. So we just started talking. But I mean, that's me. A friend is someone I haven't met. I mean, a stranger is a friend that I haven't met yet. Because they're all friends. It's like, hi, it's my best friend. Like that little kid. So, but we end up talking, and this lady just opens up to me. And it's not that I'm not used to that, because that is how things happen for me. I don't know what that's about. It just, I walk out the bathroom with a new friend. I don't know what it is. Maybe I listen. I don't know. But she starts telling me all these things about herself, and she starts crying. And I so want to just hold her and tell her it's gonna be all right. She's okay. But it's COVID and I can't touch her. So yes. And even like the baby, the next door neighbor. It's a baby. You want to touch the baby. You want to smell the baby. You want to touch your little toes. But no, I don't want to be responsible for the baby being sick. So yeah, there's a lot of, yeah. And I think that one of the things though for me is my kid and I have the kind of relationship that is very, I think it's much more physical than a lot of other people's relationships are. So like when we watch TV, I'll reach out and I'll hold my kid's hand. And I don't know if my kid likes it or not. My kid doesn't, as far as I know, doesn't not like it. I mean, however it goes. So we'll watch movies and I'll hold my kid's hand. And my husband and I, we hug and kiss, and so I think I get a lot of affection from the people in my house. But yeah, outside it has, and like I said, it's painful because man, I wanted to touch that lady. I wanted to, oh, I so wanted to hold her. I just so wanted to hold her. Yeah. Okay.
What are some of your hopes for a longer term future?
Whew. I can't say everything I think.
You can.
Was going to say, my first thought, Jesus, come down here and shake these people up so they can stop tearing up stuff and fighting. Stop all that hating. Love everybody. So that's the first thing that came to my mind. So, so if Jesus is gonna come and do that, then that's my first thing. So if that's not what's gonna happen, then again, I guess it goes back to that understanding our interconnectivity between us, between not only us as a species, but with all living things, and taking responsibility for that. Because once we embrace ourselves and our relationship with this planet upon which we live, and understand that she provides for us our everything, our water, our food, that we should treat her with respect and do all that we can to help her so that she can better sustain us. So yeah, that's what that would be it.
Who's been supportive of you when you need support during the last couple of years?
My family, my sister and I have a number of siblings, but I have my sister who, my mother has two children, and that sister and I are very close. So my sister has been there. I have a cousin who is like a sister. She's been there. My husband, my children, got lots of friends, have a therapist. I got a new therapist because my old therapist and I, we needed to change our relationship. So I got a new therapist. I really like my new therapist. It was a good move. Yeah, my neighbors, if I need, I have my support system. It's really, I've got a good support system. I've got a great support system in very many ways because it's very diverse, and in every way, it's diverse and people of different religions and different thoughts, and it's diverse and economically and ethnicity and race and. There are people in different parts of the world. So if I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and was having a hard time, I have people in other parts of the world that I could call who were up or yeah. So I've got I my support system is pretty, I got a good support system. And like I said, I joined that other group. So I mean yeah, good is when it comes to support.
What are some of the things that you've done to take care of yourself?
Other than eating chocolate?
That's a good one.
I love my hair. I really love my hair. So I've been, I play with my hair. That's one of the things that I do, take care of myself. There are so many things that I'm not doing to take care of myself. I recently said in my group when we were talking about that, what do people do? What's your morning routine look like? And I said, I have the morning routine that every 10-year-old envies. I have the whole day that every 10-year-old envies. I get up when I get up and I do what I do and I don't what I don't. And for better or for worse, that is the truth. And so if I don't want to, I don't. So maybe that's part of how I take care of myself. But I am also aware that by not doing what I don't want to do, I end up piling stuff up for me to do at some point, and I have to do it. So there is that. And I also love dolls. I love talking about dolls. I love thinking about dolls. I like looking at dolls. I'm learning how to sculpt dolls. I like watching the doll sculpting shows. I like the repaints, I'm fascinated by dolls. I love dolls. So there's that. And music. I love music. I love music. And it's just music. I mean that I love music. All genres, and it's not like I love every singer or I like them all the same. There's some that I like more than others, but I love music and flowers. Yeah, I used to not let my husband buy me flowers. I used to, it's like that's just a waste of money. They've been cut, they're dead. It's just a slow death. And then one day, my kid and my husband went shopping, and my kid said, "You should buy mom flowers." I said, "No, your mom doesn't like flowers." My kid convinced my husband to buy me flowers. My husband buys me flowers, and it's like, "Oh, I really like these flowers." So I think I must really like flowers too. And I want to get back into gardening. I got lots of rose bushes outside. Lots of the people who lived in my house who had it built, they must have been like masochists or something. There's 30 rose bushes on my property. Nobody got time for that. Ain't nobody got time for that. But they smell good. And every once in a while, I'll go out there and start hacking at them because I just cannot. I don't know if you know how to take care of rose bushes, but you're supposed to cut down the flower down to one of the five leaves. Ain't nobody got time to do that with 30 rose bushes. No, I mean, no. No. That's not for teach. Oh, I know another thing I've been doing that's good for me. Is that the, are we on that question? Oh, good. I started buying myself clothes. I have for, oh, probably the last, well, as long as I've been on maternity leave, I've been wearing t-shirts and jeans or sweats or sweatshirts. So I'm starting to wear some other clothes. And I bought myself some shorts recently and I was like, oh, wait a minute, I like this. I like these shorts. So I am starting to buy myself some non-sweatshirt jean t-shirt clothing. So I'm doing that too.
What do you think scholars in the social sciences and humanities, so departments like film or literature or sociology or poli sci, what should we be doing to help us understand the human side of the pandemic?
What you're doing. Talking to people. You talk and you listen. There is one of the things that I find most interesting about this interview is it is healing. Because, I know that deep down, I feel a lot of sadness. Maybe anger too. There is anger and disappointment about things that haven't happened because of the pandemic. I also feel that way about things that have happened because of the pandemic, like Francis's death. In talking, not only am I telling you about my experiences and those kinds of things, it's getting me to think about some things, and it's like, do I really feel that way? Oh, I forgot about that thing. So that's good. And that's healing. Because just to be able to just talk and say, yeah, I feel this way. Yeah, this is really how I feel. Or to tell you a sad story. Because it's like you just walk down the street. Well, the lady picking up the rocks told me your sad story. But I think most of us don't just walk down the street and tell people our sad stories. So that's healing. So I think that in doing what you're doing, you are not only capturing what's happening, you're helping people to make sense of their own unique experiences and giving them a chance to talk about them. And that is healing. So I thank you for the interview. Yeah.
This is my last question. I'd
Oh,
like
do I
you
want chocolate? Yeah.
I'd like you to imagine speaking to a historian in the future, someone far enough away that they have no lived experience of this moment. As they go forward with their research into the pandemic in 2020, What would you want them to be sure they don't forget about this moment as they go forward and do this work? What do you want to be sure does not get forgotten by them?
So often, we talked about this earlier, history is told by the victor. I want historians to make sure to look at how the pandemic impacts the people who are voiceless, who don't have access to monies and health and that kind of thing. I want them to talk to minority communities. Like, I have a friend who has had COVID twice now. And when she got it the first time, I asked her, "Did you get your booster?" And she told me, "No, I didn't even think about it." So when she got it the second time, I said, "Did you get your booster?" And she said, "No, I have a cousin who got it. She got COVID and she's sicker than a dog." I want people to talk to people. I want them to understand why, especially Black people, are impacted so strongly. And part of it for us is we are afraid. This country has a history of using us as guinea pigs. We see this country using people in Africa as guinea pigs. So we are less likely to do some of the things. We are a harder group of people to convince to do these things. And like I said, we lost a lot of us. You know, we were the ones who had to go to work. I want historians to understand that. I want them to understand that impoverished people really hit hard. You know, before we got this vaccine, those are the people. And then you have to understand, you know, I don't even know if you can understand. You have to look at Trump and the decisions that he made. And why he made them. Because when we first started experiencing COVID, it tended to be in Democratic areas. And Trump didn't seem to be too concerned about us. He didn't tend to be too concerned about that population. And then it's like it started, you know, everybody's getting it. So, oh, look, this is, oh, it's not just in New York. Oh my God, the people dying in such numbers that they can't even put them in the ground. They got them in the trucks. They have put people's bodies in the trucks, in the like trucks that you would move food in because they got to keep them cold and they got to, you have to look at how it impacted people. Those people whose stories we don't normally tell, those people who tend to be absent, make sure that their stories are told. Make sure that you look at the history of masks. We were told to create and wear cloth masks. And it wasn't, I don't think, until this year that they said, oh, well, that was supposed to be a temporary thing. Those masks can't really keep you safe. I mean, they keep you safer. You should be wearing, you know, the KN95s, or we didn't know that. We didn't know I'm angry about how the government did not take care of the people, how the dishonesty with wearing the mask, and then the whole fighting about who gets to make the vaccine and where the vaccine comes. Yeah, that needs to be looked at. And the fear, the general fear that people had, people just, we saw people in Italy, they all staying in, and but they were singing. And that's another thing. The beauty, the blessings that came out of COVID. Make sure to look and see, because I think that one of the things that the historians will see, at least if they look, is it was like one of those Dickens sentences, from, was it the, can't think of the book, it's the best of times, the worst of times. Because there are some beautiful things that happen. There's some beautiful things that happen. And I have to remember that. There's been, because I've been talking so much about these bad things and horrible things. But like I said, my family was all home, so we got to spend time together. Yeah, I look at the people. Look at the people and how it impacted the people. Make sure to break down those numbers and look at what they mean. So no, it's like, so this many million of people died. How many of them were impoverished? How many of them were of color? How many of them were disabled? How many of them, look at how it impacted groups, because you're going to find that it impacted different groups differently. Like I said earlier, with like the Native Americans, when you've got people who, some of these people are living, multi-generational houses, and they don't have running water, and they're being told to wash their hands. How something as simple as that impacted them. Also, look at the strange thing. Because God knows we are a weird species. The guy who went out for miles from around his house and bought up all the hand sanitizer and the what do you call those surface wipes, like Lysol wipes. He got his whole garage filled up with all that stuff. Then he can't get rid of them. He can't take it back to the store. Nobody wants his stuff back. He was trying to sell them, and he was trying to sell them for way too much. You got to look at those people. You got to look at the people who, were going to make their millions on toilet paper. You're out there buying all the toilet paper so you can get any. You got to see them. Because there's got to be some humor in this too, Because there's, I mean, I know I was laughing. This is funny. Yeah. The human condition. The COVID. Every aspect of the human condition, you can look at it and see it in COVID, but it's like it's compounded, or because it's like, oh, look over here at this. This is hilarious. You look at this, oh, this is so sad. Look at this grief. Then you have these children who are being born, and the babies that haven't seen each other, and look at the joy of them seeing each other. Every single aspect of the human condition. Look, and I think you will see that if not every, almost every aspect of our condition has been blown up during COVID. The love, the hate, people are angry. We're angry about COVID. We're angry about, and then it's just like everything came together. Black Lives Matter. Now we got the whole thing with Roe v. Wade, and how abortion, and it's just like, it's heavy. This is a heavy It's heavy, but you know, also it's going to be like amazing. It's interesting to live through history because by living through this, I think I have a better understanding of my elders and our movement, you know, the Black movements. I think I have a better understanding of what that was like, of some of the things that they dealt with because of COVID. It takes everybody down to their base. You know, you don't have enough money to not die from COVID. Now you can have you can not have enough money to make you have to be out there and be more likely to die from COVID. You don't have enough money to not die from COVID. You don't have enough money to not catch COVID. You don't have enough money to not have to be sheltered in your house. In some ways, it made us one. That's kind of cool. I hadn't thought about that before. The common boogeyman. Okay, I talked your face off.
I want to thank you so much for the generosity of your time and the kind beauty of your answers. Those are all the questions I know how to ask at the moment. So right now, I just want to open some space. If there's anything you want to talk about that my questions haven't made room for, please take some space and share it.
I talked to you about a whole bunch of stuff. I'm trying to think if there's anything I didn't. I think it's going to be important, like I said, to break things down and to look at the stories from different vantage points because I think that that's going to be really interesting when this is over with and to see how many, like, I think that I have, I don't know if I have developed, am developing, like a fear of going outside. And part of the reason that I have that fear is because I have been so well sheltered, because my husband has been the one who's been out doing grocery shopping and whatever. Like I told you, I wanted to hold the lady. I am touchy. And so I have to really, I have to be not mean when I'm in public, if that makes any sense. Because I want to touch everybody. I want to, So when this is over with, what will, how many of us are going to be in the house and unable to leave? And it has been good to have, even you have doctor's visits online. You know, it is good and it is safe. But there's a flip side to that because, like me, I don't know when I will ever feel okay to go out without a mask. I could see myself 5 years from now still wearing a mask, and that frightens me. That frightens me. And I can see myself wearing a mask for different reasons. One, I pray that they know enough about COVID that we're getting shots like we get flu shots and it's not a big deal. But also just, it's true. There's a sense of distrust. There is a sense of just, I have a sense of distrust because On the one hand, I understand people saying, oh, I don't want to wear a mask anymore. I wore a mask for however long I lived, wore a mask. But when people decide not to wear a mask, it's like, guys, you're taking my life. You're possibly impacting my life by choosing not to wear a mask. For whatever reason, you are choosing to not wear a mask. And I think that the majority of the people who are not wearing masks are doing it because they don't want to wear a mask. It's not because, I mean, I know there are people who have breathing issues or whatever. I mean, there are real reasons why you shouldn't wear a mask. But yeah, it's kind of scary to think that there are people out there who is not wearing a mask. I wonder how many of them ended up like Meatloaf. Meatloaf, he wore a mask and then he's like, oh yeah, I'm done. I'm not wearing a mask anymore. I'm tired. I'm not living like this. So he died like that, not wearing his mask. Yeah, COVID is deep. I guess living is deep. Yeah. I can't think of anything else. Thank you for, like I said, thank you for the interview and thank you for giving me this time to reflect and to analyze my feelings and my fears and the things I look forward to. It's been good. This is a good thing.
Thank
Thank
you so
you.
much.
Thank you.